Thank you, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. I know a lot of you had a busy day today, the Standard Life event, so thank you for joining us after that. So what we're going to cover, a few minutes, just give a little bit more detail on the transaction we've announced today in respect of the Scottish Equitable back book. And then I'm joined here with Kerrigan Proctor as well, and Kerrigan will take you through some of the wider dynamics going on in the annuity market as we speak, and how we seek to take advantage of that. Now, hopefully you should have access to a set of slides we just made available on our website, so I will verbally refer to which slide I'm talking to. Clearly, if you haven't got access, you need to find so very quickly, because that will help to navigate the way through the presentation. At the end of that, we'll obviously take questions in the normal way. If we can today, I'd like to keep it restricted to this transaction and annuities rather than getting on to generic questions. So for those people who would like to ask other things, if we can keep today focused, I will be grateful. Thank you. Right, so talking to slide two, first in the pack we've just sent out, this gives a little bit more detail on the actual transaction we've announced. So to get some precise numbers out there to clear up any ambiguity, so the actual premium paid ultimately, which we agreed yesterday, was $2.93 billion. So when we talk about $3 billion, for those of you who like precision, the real number was £2.93 billion, the ultimate premium paid. These are all annuitants in payment. So this was business sold by Aegon, individual business sold by Aegon primarily between the years 2007 and 2010, all annuitants at that point in time. So the average age of the annuitant on this book is between 70 and 71. So just a little bit more colour there in terms of the shape of the liabilities we've taken on. As we made clear in our press release and RNS this morning, this is originally by way of a reinsurance contract with Aegon, but we are both parties looking to do a Part 7 transfer into the Legal and General Life Fund in due course. But clearly that does need regulatory and court approval, so we can't presuppose that, but that is definitely the long-term goal that that both parties are moving towards. At that point, it'll cease to be a reinsurance contract, and we'll take over all the administration of the annuitants at that point in time. In terms of the pricing of the deal, actually we're not going to give away exactly kind of how we priced it from our perspective, but it's fair to say that all our discipline pricing remains intact. As you know, we have a required hurdle rate where we put capital at risk in the annuity market, and this deal has certainly met those hurdle rates. So we're not going to get drawn anymore in terms of the exact dynamics and financials of the deal. Simply to say that we have at least met our required hurdle rates where we put capital at risk. We gave obviously a little bit more colour today in terms of the actual Solvency II dynamics. A couple of things to say there, that the PRA have granted that we can use transitional relief for the risk margin that's set up as a result of this, taking this on board. So effectively it has something akin to kind of pre-Solvency II dynamics in that regard. The risk margin now has been mitigated by the fact we are allowed to create a transitional in respect of this business. As a result of that, the net surplus strain, I do use the word surplus, so this is a combination of own funds going up as well as an increase in the solvency capital requirement, but the net of those two is an increase, essentially a decrease in our surplus by £50 million, i.e. the SCR requirement for this deal is £50 million higher than the boost to own funds that it creates. And that calculation by grossing up both the numerator in our coverage ratio and our denominator means that it will result in an approximate reduction of 3 percentage points in our coverage ratio as a result. In terms of kind of wider strategy, again, I'll let Kerry can cover this off a little more, but we have been talking about back book consolidations as one of our nine sources of profits for quite some time. And without getting too excited, there is a almighty back book of individual annuitants in the UK, which we estimate to be about £100 billion. And that's not to say for a second that's all going to come to market, but nevertheless, it does give some indication of that there is a significant books out there. And it's fair to say I think most businesses now are taking a view on whether they want to be in this market or not going forward. I think Solvency II has created that need for people to clarify in their own minds whether that's a key part of their strategy going forwards or not. And clearly, as well as this one today, we will point to the Lucida deal back in 2013, the $1.4 billion that we took on board there, and again, a very smooth integration which worked very well. So again, we believe now establishing a track record in terms of these back book consolidations. That's all I wanted to say on slide two. So moving then to slide three. Again, just a couple of other points to pull off of slide three. This is just to clarify some of the debates we had when we announced our prelims in March of this year. So on the bar charts on the left-hand side here, just showing the solvency coverage ratio, if we calculated it using what we've called the peer method rather than the PRA method. And to be absolutely clear what we've included there, all I've done is simply include the SCR and associate and equivalent own funds associated with our with-profit funds, so around £650 million. I've simply deducted that from both sides of the equation. I reduced that from the own funds and taken out of the SCR as well. What I've not done in our case is do the same thing for the circa £80 million of SCR and own funds associated with our in-house pension schemes. I've done it because actually my view is that the scheme is in deficit. I don't think it holds intellectual logic to adjust the coverage ratio accordingly. For those of you who want to have a compare like-for-like with other people in our sector, it is £80 million is the SCR associated with our pension scheme, so you can do the maths for yourself. But to be very clear, the 175 we're quoting here on what we call a peer basis only allows for the adjustment for the 650 million, or circa 650 million, of own funds and SCR associated with our with-profits fund. I've covered off the point around the impact of this transaction on our pro forma balance sheet. So I think at that point, I'll hand over to Kerrigan to talk more generally through what's going on in the market and LNG's success in that space.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mark. I think I'll just do a quick talk through why LGR has been a growth business and just reiterate our confidence that LGR will continue to be a growth business. Just on slide five, I've laid out some of the figures there, story that you're familiar with, of course, but I thought it would be handy to put the figures all on one page. You can see the growth story in terms of op cash or net cash or op profit live on that page there. I think a really positive story indeed. Just in terms of a little bit of detail in terms of the Q1 2016 figures on there, 410 million of bulk annuity business written. There was 550 million year to date in the press report once you add a couple of other deals and individual annuity business, you get to the 550 million year to date in total annuities. Just moving on to slide six, we talk a lot about our nine sources for profit. I won't talk about these in any great length because that will take the time for the rest of the phone call, so I'll just quickly canter down the line there. And I think we try to be helpful on the right-hand side by saying how we think of this business in terms of capital usage. So quick run down the line, back book for cash. You've seen the size of our annuity portfolio, and we've said for the first time we expect that to throw off of £10 billion of undiscounted cash over approximately the next 60 years. Very long runoff, but further on and in the press release we talked about of the order of £400 million per annum for the next 5 years of cash just from the back book. That's just prudence that's in there already. Clearly, as we work hard on the assets and source, the sorts of direct investments and self-manufactured assets that we like and have started to grow, then I think there's further upside than that. The point there is we think that is very much like a Solvency I-like release rather than Solvency II because of this existence of transitional relief. Further point, backbook acquisitions. So we talked about the $2.93 billion Aegon deal today. I'm sure further questions on that, so I'll come back to that later. But just to confirm, that's like the rest of the backbook. That's Solvency I-like release, we think, because of the transitional relief. I'll talk a bit in the future about UK capital light front book, but this is $1.8 trillion of defined benefit liabilities in the UK, and we're thoroughly and still enthused about that story. I'll talk a little bit about the US pension risk transfer market, which at $2.5 trillion, $2.6 trillion in terms of liabilities is also a really interesting market to us. Longevity insurance is another market that's been quiet recently, but we're still interested in that market and keen to participate, helping our clients transfer their pension risk away in that market. Lifetime mortgages, you can see there, not only the $200 million written in 2015, the press release talked about $150 million written year-to-date in lifetime mortgages, new loans in that market. So that continues to be an additional growth story for us. We have our global reinsurance hub, so LNG Re, A-plus rated, Solvency II equivalent, and now with registered reinsurer status in the Netherlands. And again, we think that could be an interesting market for growth. Individual annuities, clearly a market that's shrunk a lot, but we see signs of industry consolidation actually leading to being a little bit more constructive about that market. clearly it's not as big as some of the big bulk opportunities or backbook opportunities, but again, it's a constructive story. Finish off with the secondary annuity market there. Well, I guess we'll wait and see. We're reasonably positive about that market, but I'm sure more will be talked about that in the months and quarters to come, so I won't say anything more about that here today. I will touch upon, on slide 7, the UK pension risk transfer opportunity. I think it's always interesting, with the little pie chart at the bottom, which shows that somewhat less than 10% of the UK defined benefit pension liabilities have transferred from pension schemes to the insurance sector. So there certainly is plenty of upside there and plenty of demand from our defined benefit clients to exit their largely legacy pension schemes. And certainly the messaging around challenges in the retail and steel sectors, should we say, I'm sure will reinforce the wish of many people to pass on the risks of their defined benefit pension schemes. I think there's something very similar going on in the US. As you know, we're now participating in the US market. Lots of interesting deals, potential pipeline there shown in figures. So $13.2 billion written in the market in 2015. And from what we're seeing, it looks like a similar size pipeline or slightly bigger for 2016. So I think a really interesting market. The difference between the US market, many differences, many similarities, but one of the key differences is liabilities, pension benefits in the US, private sector pension benefits tend to be not inflation linked. And so their valuation is sensitive to changes in nominal rates, unlike the UK where most benefits are inflation linked. Valuation sensitive to real rates. So as we see the potential for that US rate cycle shifting earlier than other markets, and certainly a nominal rate shifting, then the affordability of pension plans to buy out, we think, will increase. And so we're keen to be in that market in the long term, but also I think there's some interest in the short term as well in that market. One of the questions we get asked a lot about is longevity reinsurance. So I just touched upon that in slide 9. You saw some of these figures at the end of the year results, I think. So a gross exposure of longevity risk on our back book around about $48.7 billion, and after reinsurance, our net exposure of $37.1 billion. And that's through doing that, we've got established relationships with about a dozen reinsurers and live deals with a subset of those. But it gives us great access to the reinsurance market. And I think more broadly, when we're answering our clients' needs for pension de-risking, we have a lot of skills that we bring to that, and I think behind us there's a deep global pool of capital to not just back those existing reinsurers, but more broadly I've seen a lot of interest in talking to other participants who want to enter the market as a reinsurer in one form or another. So I feel confident that there will be that deep global pool of capital to back those reinsurance relationships going forward. I'm conscious that I've been talking quite a long while now, so I'll just finish off on slide 10. Pop back to Mark for a few seconds and then open up to questions. But I just wanted to talk about what we think of as our USPs in the UK. We clearly have the most extensive UK client reach across the firm. There are 6,300 UK private sector schemes and 3,000 are already our clients. So also, we can uniquely offer clients all steps in pension de-risking. That could be diversification of assets, it could be LDI, it could be longevity reinsurance, it could be buy-in or buy-out or combinations of any of those. We're the only company that can do all those things. I think the other thing that's important in the market is integrated asset management. So when I think about this business, it is liability-driven investment in its purest form, and we are, of course, leaders in liability-driven investment in the UK and very substantial that in the US market. You need a global fixed income capability, and you need a real assets and self-manufacturing capability. You need to bring that together all at speed to deliver to the pace that clients want to work at. On longevity management, well, we've had 29 years in the bulk market. That's given us seasoned longevity data and longevity expertise, and we have 25 people dedicated to research and analysis in the longevity space. I'd say rather than just longevity risks, longevity management, because I think we're an attractive reinsurance counterparty. We think about our longevity expertise, diversified business, financial strength, balance sheet size, client reach and structuring skills, then I'm sure you can see that lots of reinsurers are keen to work with us as a preferred counterparty. The barriers to entry in the UK DB market are quite substantial. We have, over those 29 years, I think, seen virtually every type of complex defined benefit pension there is and we could administer all of them, but no simple task there. And then finally, I think through our brand and through our demonstration of deal execution at pace, meeting all the client's needs in various deals, clients can have confidence in execution in working with us. So I think those are our USPs in the UK, and we are rapidly trying to recreate those in the US, with which I head over to Mark.
Great. Thanks, Kogan. So just to finish off then on slide 11, again, here, just trying to help you a bit with just thinking about the future dynamics of the financials of this business. So we have for today disclosed the first time if you like, the VIF, the value in force of our LNG retirement business, which based on year-end 15, 31 December 15, 5 billion on a discounted basis and 10 billion on an undiscounted basis. Not precise numbers, but close enough to give you a directional feel. And it is that undiscounted VIF which we would expect to flow through and feed the operational cash going forwards. As we said in our press release, and indeed as we said in our introductory comments, we're expecting that to be of the order of £400 million per year for the next 5 years. But as Kogan says, that runs off over something like 60 years in total, although clearly it does run down a bit over that time. A couple of obvious points to add on top of that is based on the on some reasonably prudent assumptions based at year-end. We do think the scope to augment that, particularly on the asset side, through by sourcing more attractively priced direct investments, increasing our proportion of lifetime mortgages. You know, we just started that the first time just over a year ago now. We've written £150 million so far in 2016 and have a target of £500 million pounds for lifetime mortgages this year to add to the £200 million that we wrote last year. Further upside, we still have reasonably cautious assumptions around the long-term default provisions. Again, we'd expect some of that to do better than that in terms of how we incentivize our fund managers. So again, we would hope on the credit side of the equation we could do better than the default allowances we allow for in our best estimates. And clearly, the last effect is as we augment with new business. Now, so the graph at the bottom there, so 27 onwards, for example, will benefit from the 3.5 billion of annuities we've written so far this year. So that VIF runoff there is purely based on the 31 December 15 position, since which we've written profitable business thereafter. That will augment the expected release in the year subsequent to any new business that we write. So again, that should also be a source of augmentation to that VIF monetization profile we showed at the bottom of page 11. I think with that's all the major points we wanted to get across in our presentational piece. At that point, I'll open up the call to any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. If you change your mind and wish to remove your question, please press star followed by two. And please ensure that when preparing to ask your question, your phone is unmuted locally. Our first question comes from Gordon Aitken from RBC. Gordon, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. First, three quick questions, please. First on strain. There's a very low level of strain in this transaction, 1.7%, quite a bit lower than I understand is usual in large DB bulks. Why is it lower, and is this something to do with the lack of competition at that very large end? Secondly, on just the mechanics of how this works on the asset side, I mean, how do the assets come across? Is it cash? Is it an in-specie transfer? And what assets would you look to invest in? And third, I mean, this back book has quite different characteristics to the $6 billion book that was bought by Rothsay. It's quite a different book. This is open market. Why did you either win or choose to win this one, not the other? Is it something to do with your open market experience? Would the strain have been materially different on the other book? If you can comment on that. Thank you.
Right. I think I should probably both answer those. But actually, because Kogan's sitting next to me, I'll let Kogan answer all three. But if he gets stuck, I shall butt in.
Very good. Yeah, Gordon, I think on the first point, yes, it is an attractive strain and I think an attractive premium. We worked for a long time with Aegon to make sure that we're both happy with the transaction and we're certainly happy with that premium that we charge. Just in terms of the asset side, these are mostly coming across from Aegon in specie, but as you can imagine, they had a diversified book of mainly sterling credit, mostly names that we were happy with. We've got a little bit of transitioning But effectively, instantly, we had the credit spread risk that we wanted and the interest rate risk that we wanted. Because these were individual annuities, there's virtually no inflation risk in them. So day one, pretty much hedged, and then it pretty much dropped into the back book, and it's working on getting some upside through increased allocation to self-manufactured assets, direct investment over the coming years. So a very familiar in-specie asset book that's come across and leaves us with very, very little transition risk at all. I think really important to talk about the different characteristics of this book and the longevity risk on this book. As Mark said, these were annuities sold in the open market that Aegon collected, mainly in the years 2007 to 2010. So individual annuities in that market. Now, I think the important thing is that this external open market option is clearly a market that we've been participating in strongly for many years, and indeed we're participating in during that period. So we were able to compare the mortality, the experience, the characteristics of that book in huge detail against our own portfolio and really get to grips with the longevity risk thoroughly on that book of Aegon's. And really, you could only have done that if you were live and very active in the external market during that period. And so clearly, if you think of the people who might have been interested in the book and the people who are able to do that, that pretty much narrows down to, I think just one participant, basically. So we got very comfortable with that risk, but it would have been harder for people without that experience and back book to get comfortable with, I think.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from John Hocking from Morgan Stanley. John, please go ahead.
Afternoon. I've got two questions, please. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the hurdle rate for the deal. You said it's sort of in line with your usual hurdle rate. Yeah, are you loading 150% Solvency II capital against this, AA capital? You know, how are you thinking philosophically about the capital loading? And then secondly, I realize this is a transaction where you benefit from the transitionals, but on a go-forward basis, if you were going to do a chunky transaction in the Solvency II world, yeah, where are the PRA sitting at the moment in terms of longevity reinsurance? They've made a lot of noises, obviously, about motivations in terms of risk margin, et cetera. Do you think there's an opportunity to do similarly large deals with longevity reinsurance that don't benefit from transitionals? Thank you.
Okay, cheers, John. I'll pick up the first one on hurdle rate. Perhaps let Kerry can comment on generally the use of longevity reinsurance and the PRA's views on it. On the hurdle rate, John, I understand why you want to know. I think we have to take the view that is commercially sensitive from our side. As I've tried to reassure in the past, we do recognise this business is not without risk. We are deploying shareholder capital to back this business. Therefore, we are very minded to achieve an appropriate return on that capital. And it's, I would say it's an attractive return from a shareholder's perspective, but I'm not prepared to give away, John, because that's the sort of thing which EBCs and other advisors in the market, if they knew what our pricing basis was, they would use that against us. So can I just reassure you that we recognise it is shareholder capital, we recognise that business is not without risk, and therefore we want to ensure we get an appropriate return for the risk we are taking. We do believe we can manage that risk very well and realise that into real profits, but I'm not prepared to give away our precise hurdle rate that we're trying to achieve.
Okay. Is the hurdle rate the same for annuities versus other business you might write across the group?
Yeah. So the actual risk capital we set aside is actually adjusted for the actual risk of each risk we take on. So since which we have riskier business, that has a higher capital charge and vice versa. So having got the right level of risk capital we're assigning, then the hurdle rate for that risk capital remains the same. But clearly the actual quantum of risk capital does vary based on the nature of the risk we're bringing onto our balance sheet.
Okay.
And John, just on the other point, clearly I can't comment on private conversations with the PRA, so I just give my broader thoughts on that. What we're looking at here is, when we use longevity reinsurance, we're talking about genuine risk reduction, so I think no surprise if genuine risk reduction leads to reduced risk-based capital, i.e. SCR, and reduced risk margin, and I don't think there's any particular strong objection to that. And then in terms of counterparty risk, well, I think all parties, ourselves included, and I'm sure you too, are keen to know that we have robust counterparty management in place. So we think a lot about due diligence, really the three Ds. It's due diligence, diversification of counterparties, and daily collateral, and that's what we resolutely stick to, and I think all participants and all stakeholders agree that that's a very sensible framework to work within. So I don't think anybody's talking about anything surprising and left field. It's genuine risk reduction and sensible counterparty management wins the day.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Greg Patterson from KBW. Greg, please go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Greg.
Good. Two questions. I mean, an investor asked me, they've done this deal, how much economic value has been created, and i.e., what's the price? Now, you've dropped embedded value margin on this type of business going forward. I mean, how are we going to judge whether you've paid too much or too little, or what the economic merits of this? I'd like your thoughts in that regard. Second question is, given the importance of the strong credit rating you have and your marketing message to trustees, what would be, and hence the appropriateness of, say, a AA S&P model, what would be the strain that this deal has resulted versus the $50 million on a Solvency I BBB basis? And the third thing is, one of your competitors told me recently that pricing and capacity in the by reinsurers to take on longevity risk has deteriorated for the primaries like yourself recently. And is that the reason why you have decided not to on-sell some of the risk like you decided to last year on this particular deal?
Okay, thanks, Greg. I'll pick up the first one, say a few words about the second one, perhaps let Kerrigan again talk about the why we haven't, at this stage at least, reinsured any of the longevity on this transaction. On the embedded value created by this deal, Greg, clearly you made a couple of points there. One, we haven't disclosed, and secondly, your point around the fact we are proposing to drop EV reporting going forwards. I would say on that latter point, just to reassure you, we are working hard to think about giving the market a value creation metric in a Solvency II world. I'm working hard to try and have that in a robust state for the half year. So we do recognise that some sense of value creation is still an important metric and certainly one we think about a lot internally. So provided that work gets to a robust enough state at that time we do our interims on the 9th of August, I would hope to be able to give you some indication of a sense to which the new business we've written during the course of any reporting period has created value in a Solvency II world. So that will have many consistencies with embedded value, but clearly will factor in the cost of capital associated with Solvency II rather than the S1, which underpinned our EV disclosure. So we will try and help you by way of value creation on this particular deal.
In effect, you're not going to drop embedded value. You're going to do a embedded value.
New business, we're working very hard for new business to give you some sense of a new business value add, which is what we won't be giving you, though, Greg, is a full EV balance sheet with all the other features.
How do we judge the merits of the assumption set if we don't have the detailed parameters?
As I say, Greg, we try and make sure it's as robust as possible, and if it's robust, we'll clearly make sure it's easy enough for you to interpret how we come at that number. So that means divulging some of the underlying assumptions, we will do that.
Excellent.
As well. The team are working very hard currently just to find a robust basis for doing that for external reporting purposes, and that's certainly the ambition as we sit here today. So I can't commit to it fully at this stage, but we'll certainly try and help you understand. We understand that the question you want to have answers. We will try and help you answer it come the half year and beyond that. In terms of the importance of our credit rating and any strain this creates to S&P and Moody models, etc. Now, could we haven't taken this deal precisely through them, but I would say in the overall scheme of things, now you've seen the strain it creates from an IFRS perspective and the Solvency II perspective. In the overall scheme of things, for this particular transaction, Greg, this is not one that's going to create much of a delta between what we've disclosed on our S2 impact compared to how that would be interpreted by the credit rating agencies. Now, clearly, we are mindful of our credit rating. We know it's a source of some competitive advantage to us, and therefore, you know, we are cognizant of the impact it may have. But, say, this deal has got, you know, quite attractive commercials, so we would not expect this to have any material impact on the way that the main credit agencies actually think about our balance sheet.
Yeah, I think, Greg, just on the why not on-sell the longevity risk, well, I think a couple of things. Firstly, as I said earlier, we got ourselves very comfortable with the longevity risk on this book, number one. Secondly, and importantly, the existence of transitional relief removes some of the desire to remove that you see under pure Solvency II business. And really, in the presence of those two things, it looks and feels just like a further part of our back book. As you can see from the slides, we've reinsured roughly 25% of our back book. It drops into the back book, and we'll pick and choose which parts of the back book that we want to reinsure in the future, but certainly no huge desire to necessarily reinsure large parts of the back book further from the 25% reinsurance that we got. So really the point is, it sits in with the rest of the back book, and we'll pick and choose which parts of that we want to reinsure in the future, but no real incentive to reinsure that right now.
And is pricing, do you recognize that point that pricing has tightened a bit by the reinsurers? Does that make sense?
Not obviously. We talked in the press release about a further $300 million ICI deal, 90% reinsurance on that pricing, absolutely fine. So our evidence doesn't support that particularly.
Oh, so the 550, you've basically reinsured a good portion of that?
Yes, particularly the $300 million ICI deal.
Not the individual stuff within that, Greg, just the bulk.
Yeah, so I'm saying, if that 550, what sort of percentage must we think about as being reinsured? Of the 550 year-to-date you mentioned, yeah?
Well, I think about the 300 million ICI bulk, to 90% of that.
All right, cool. Thank you. Cheers.
Our next question comes from Andy Hughes from Macquarie. Andy, please go ahead.
Oh, hi, guys. I guess I'm looking at the Aegon press release, which seems to have a bit more information in it than yours, and I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. So if I take the $275 million Solvency II benefit and knock off your $50 million strain, does that give me the transitionals, which is sort of $225 million? And I guess the second question is, their IFRS loss is $215 million on sale. Does that mean, assuming your IFRS basis is similar, you're going to record an IFRS gain of $215 million on the other side?
Yeah, a couple of things I would say to that, Andy. First of all, it's clear that they have their own models and their own accounting, and therefore you shouldn't assume, just because it's the same risk and the same assets, that it appears equal and opposite in our balance sheet. Clearly, we didn't give the components on the Solvency II numbers, the components of the $50 million surplus impact. Clearly, that is a combination, say, of own funds going up as well as the SCR going up. Now, clearly we've got our own internal model to calculate our SCR. Likewise, Aegon will have their own internal model, and likewise, we have our own matching adjustment portfolio approved by the regulator. Again, the MA treatment isn't uniform between different models. In the overall scheme of things, clearly to an order of magnitude, the numbers are not a million miles apart, but you shouldn't assume that just because they released £275 million of capital, that means that we have, that on our side, the 275 is the equivalent number in our case. But in the overall dynamics of the balance sheet, as Gordon said in his question earlier, the strain here net equates to about 1.7% of the total premium. So we're very content with that being a good place to get the efficiency of our balance sheet to, and probably something we wouldn't actually expect fully to achieve in every case going forward. In terms of their profit, the losses they've announced on the transaction, again, you shouldn't expect that to all come through our balance sheet in the year of sale. Some of that will be prudential margin we set aside and to be released in the future. Again, our number's not exactly the same as the 215, but even if it were to be, that wouldn't all be released in year zero at the point of sale. We would set up sufficient prudential margins and then release that through operating cash as the experience comes through in line with our best estimate. So that wouldn't be a year one profit release in our case. But though we will see a benefit in the new business surplus, but not to the level of $215 million.
Okay, I just want to check I understood the bit about transitional. So obviously they do it ex-transitional. So the 225 was just, obviously you said the strain is very low, but the strain is very low because of the transitional benefit. I was just wondering what the strain would be ex-transitionals. Is it fair to add the 225 back on to the strain ex-transitionals?
Not precise, but on your point, are transitionals beneficial? Yes, they are. I'm not going to deny that's true. But to say that the missing bit in the middle is all transitional is incorrect as well. Clearly we haven't divulged any transitionals either now or in our balance sheet more generally, so I'm loath to give that away. But I would say, particularly, it's beneficial to this transaction the fact that it comes with transitionals.
Okay, thank you.
As a final reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that's star followed by one to ask a question. Our next question comes from Colm Kelly from UBS. Colm, please go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for taking my questions. Three questions, please, and I'm following up from Andy's question. Aegon indicated capital generation uplift of about 30 million per annum, a decline of 30 million per annum. Again, is there a similar impact in magnitude for yourselves? And also on the solvency surplus and ratio, can you indicate whether or not there would be an impact following the Part 7 transfer? That's the first question. Second question is around co-funds and whether there's any provision within this deal for the transfer of co-funds in the opposite direction, or is there any insight you can give us to that. And the third question is on U.S. Bulks. I'm mindful that I think last year in the 2015 industry numbers is around 300 separate contracts for, you know, under $100 million, which, you know, is a supply chain you would have been operating in. Clearly, you know, it takes time to develop a business in that market. But can you talk through some of the specific constraints that you're seeing in that market that hasn't seen you pick up more of those contracts in 2015, please? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Colm. I'll pick up your first two questions and let Kerry then talk about the U.S. Bulk market. Some of them have like a flat record in terms of the kind of clearly Aegon have given their impact on their IFRS on capital releases going forwards. Again, our numbers won't be exactly the same. You know, have we written business that we expect to be profitable going forwards? Yes, we have. So in that sense, you can do your own analysis in terms of how you think it might play out. In our case, we will have slightly different assumptions, and therefore it will release perhaps in a slightly different way to the way Aegon may have had it in their numbers. But as I say, just to reassure you, we have written this business to be profitable for us going forward. Therefore, we would expect a benefit coming through op cash and indeed further down the P&L account going forwards. In terms of any subsequent benefit to a Part 7 transfer when that comes through from our point of view, I'm not sure we expect that to be anything at all from our perspective. I suspect that Aegon having to hold some sort of counterparty risk capital against LNG, and that's, and clearly in our case that isn't true. So from our point of view, there may be some very, very small second-order effects when it gets integrated into our wider long-term fund, but it really is second, stroke, third order. I wouldn't expect a second benefit when the Part 7 transfer goes through from a pure Solvency II perspective. There will be some cost benefits at that point. Some of the things we have to do once reinsurance will fall away, but from a pure capital perspective, there won't be a subsequent benefit when the Part 7 transfer materialises. On the question about co-funds, obviously a very cheeky question, Colm, so as always I'm going to no comment anything in that regard and pass on to question three.
Yeah, just on the US bulk front, as you'll see, we closed our first smaller bulk deal, $65 million in the US. The way the US cycle works, as some of you on the call may understand well, there tends to be fewer deals in the first half of the year and more of a flurry as you go into the third quarter and fourth quarter. We are actively participating in bidding for quite a few bulk schemes in the US, certainly at the smaller end also. We have confidence in our longevity pricing. We have the asset management skills through LGMA in Chicago, of course. And you may have seen that we've built out our administration capability out of LGA Banner in Maryland. So we're up and running, ready to go, going through safest available annuity, pricing competitively on these deals. Now, of course, we go into that mindful that we don't want to win every single deal that we go in up front, so we're testing the water, finding out where the pricing lies, but really getting a good feel for where the market sits there and pretty encouraged by what we see.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's useful.
Our final question comes from Andrew Sinclair from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Andrew, please go ahead.
Afternoon, everyone. Three quick questions, if that's okay. Firstly, you previously talked, I think, about $10 billion of bulk annuity transactions that you are currently quoting on. I just wondered where that number stands today, and does that include the Aegon transactions, both the one that you've taken and the one that went through OFSI, and how much is outstanding? Secondly, just wondered if you could give just a general comment on what you've seen with individual and bulk annuity pricing since the full year. Since the introduction of Solvency II. And thirdly, just wondered if you get any comments on the potential recalibration of the risk margin. The PRA's commentary seemed to suggest that they'd like to see that recalibrated. Just wondered if you had any commentary on what you've heard. Thanks.
Okay, cheers, Andy. So I'll let Kerrigan talk to the first two there, and I'll pick up on anything we can say about the risk margin recalibration.
Fantastic. Yeah, so the 10 billion pipeline that we'd have talked about, and we think of pension risk transfer business in the round, so whether that's bulk or buy-ins, buyouts, longevity, UK, US, and really think of those things together. Clearly, when we made that comment before that we were mindful of the Aegon deal, and what you see with this market is there's always a pipeline of large schemes looking to talk. Sometimes those turn into deals this year, and sometimes they turn into deals in the next couple of years, and sometimes they go away for a few years. So, you know, I think there's the Aegon's a chunk out of the market, but it's still a very substantial pipeline that the market is looking at, not exclusively with us, but the market's looking at. So I feel confident in sorts of figures that we're talking about in the slides of 10 to 12 billion this year. That's certainly feasible, I think, in terms of the deals are out there. Somewhat depends on precise timing and conditions over the year. But, yes, it's a strong market, strong client desire. I think in terms of individual and bulk pricing, then possibly a little tightening of pricing. So maybe pensioner pricing up a little bit, deferred pricing up a little bit, probably deferred pricing up a little bit more than pensioner pricing. But from the client's perspective and therefore their willingness to transact, I think that's been completely outweighed by the widening of credit spreads, for example, over the year compared to last year, somewhat offset by the level of rates. But really, when you think about it, the sort of pricing difference that we're talking about is tiny compared to the swings in equity markets or interest rates or credit spreads. So no significant reaction from clients to indicate a lack of desire to transact. And ICI, we transacted with last year. We did the big deal in 2014. They were there working with us, hitting their targets earlier this year.
Okay, just a couple of comments on the risk margin recalibration potential. I think it's fair to say there's been a lot of engagement with politicians and regulators around where the risk margin has been calibrated and the impact that is happening. I think generally there's acceptance that there's probably something that needs to be done in due course. All I would just kind of just caution is, even with some following winds, this is enshrined in primary legislation in Europe, and therefore it's quite difficult to kind of see a quick fix. I do believe in due course we may well see a slightly better outcome than we have currently for the risk margin. We have some quite onerous hardwired calibrations factored into the legislation, but I wouldn't hold you. I think in reality that could well take, you know, the Lord Hill's review of, you know, Capital Markets Review of 2018 or so to put that into a better place. We hope to find a solution to it before that, but I think in all likelihood, you know, just to kind of manage investors' expectations, I think probably it will take a couple of years for that to come to fruition. And again, I can't kind of speculate on exactly what shape that might take, but I think they say there is an acceptance that perhaps has been cut in the wrong place in terms of the calibration, so we would hope that would be beneficial, but exactly by how much and by when, I'm loath to give too much assurance on, but it is fair to say there is engagement going on in that regard as we speak.
Very good. Thanks, gents.
Cheers, Andy.
We do have a final question from Andrew Crean from Autonomous. Andrew, please go ahead.
Afternoon all. I just wanted to ask a question as to how you see the market for bulk purchase annuities this year, whether it'll be second half orientated, particularly whether Brexit is something which is holding back transactions, and whether your capacity to do deals has been constrained at all by this deal.
Both the Kerrigan, I think.
Yeah, I didn't quite hear the last word.
Is our capacity for this year in any way constrained by the crane?
Okay, right. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so is the market for bulks this year more of a second-half market? Well, we'll certainly, I mean, you've seen our update for the year in terms of bulks. It's certainly, we had a flurry of deals in December last year, as you know, that were probably brought forward for people wanting to get in before Solvency II came in. That clearly made Q1 a little bit quiet. Q2 is reasonably quiet, but see strong demand. So yeah, we would expect more to happen in H2. The point about Brexit, I mean, the only point that would risk is if you're worried about transition risk in the middle of an EU referendum, which probably you should be a little bit worried about volatility in interest rates and FX during that transition. So that would need to be managed very tightly, as it was, of course, with the Aegon deal that we just did. But it's very much a UK domestic DB runoff problem, and you've got global capital and UK insurance capital on the other side. So it's not a fundamental issue. And in the context of these deals, where a quarter is more like 25 years than 3 months, then you know, just a few weeks to the EU referendum is no time at all, and it won't, whichever result you get, it won't particularly upset that market. And the final point in terms of capacity because of Ukraine, well, I think it's back to Mark's point. We have capital, return on capital hurdle rates, and if I bring up deals that look attractive enough on those rates, then you know, there's a positive desire to look at those deals.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers, Andrew.
We have no further questions.
Okay, in that case, thank you very much for your interest, and no doubt you'll be in touch if you've got any other questions into the IR team, and we'll try and get back to you in due course. But thanks for taking the time this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Thank you.